Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now to what you, the voters, said about health care in the midterms. If health care was a midterm priority for you as a voter, what message were you specifically sending to Washington or to your state capitol? What should your representatives know about what you were voting on? Be specific here with me this morning. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Danya Palanker is with us, Assistant Research Professor at the Center on Health Insurance Reforms at Georgetown. Danya, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Jean Lambrew is with us, Senior Fellow at the Century Foundation in San Diego, California. Hi, Jean. Welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning.
Danya, if you were going to put your finger on the greatest anxiety that you think voters were feeling when they named health care as a priority, what would it be?
I think for most voters, it's losing health care for themselves, a friend or family member, either that health care was going to be undermined through a change in policy or that health care was just going to get priced out for them, you know, out of their reach. People want, you know, most people have health insurance. It's obviously an important issue for those who don't to get it. But people are scared of losing health insurance, and they're scared of the people they know and love losing health insurance.
Yes, yeah, so Danya, I mean, what's odd about that is a lot of the political dissonance, disagreement is about the ACA. Most of us are getting our insurance from employers. I want to talk to you both about that in a minute. So what is it that people who aren't on the exchanges so worried about that Washington's going to do?
I think it's a few things. First of all, most of us do get our health insurance through our employers. But what the Affordable Care Act changed was knowing that if something happens, if we lose our jobs, we don't necessarily lose access to health insurance. And that is so vital for anybody. I mean, I think of some of my friends who have children with, you know, high health needs, and the fear that they've had over the last year that promise that their child will always have health insurance could be taken away. Mm. And a lot of people really feel that they know that if they lose their job, they now have a place to go to health insurance. But it's more than that. I think we care about our friends. We care about our neighbors. And we also know people who get coverage either in Medicaid or on the exchange because of the Affordable Care Act now. And we don't want those people to lose coverage either.
Jean, I don't know if you could hear some of the calls I was taking with Ken Rudin, but I was hearing from a number of people who want our health insurance detached from employers. Is that, I think I quoted Zeke Emanuel saying he thinks this will happen within 10 years. What's your assessment of that?
You know, when you look at public opinion surveys, there is a disagreement. Recently, Kaiser Family Foundation asked people their views about single-payer Medicare for all, and nearly half of all respondents said that they think that they could keep their current plan under a single-payer Medicare for all, which is actually not accurate, but it's indications of the fact that while people do want a more affordable, safe healthcare system that's there when they need it, they also tend to fear the unknown and prefer what they have today. So I think the jury is out on whether people would want to have a choice of a public plan or Medicare-like option or would want to move from their current employer plan to such a plan.
Okay, so I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Although we're hearing this debate now about Medicare for all, I think we're going to hear that from our callers today. You're saying the reality of it, of, you know, having to be out there on the market, choosing your health insurance, you're not sure how Americans would feel about that in practice.
I'm just pointing to the surveys that show that people do think that they like their choice of their health plan.
Right.
They tend to not like paying higher taxes, which is a part of moving to a single-payer system. And I think we've seen a number of proposals that come under the umbrella of Medicare for More, as well as Medicare for All, that tries to address some of those concerns. Ideas like lowering Medicare's age eligibility to 50 or 55, or maybe beginning having a Medicare-like plan in areas where there aren't that many insurance choices. So I do think while there is more understanding that needs to happen about how we improve our healthcare system and what Medicare's role is in it, there are already emerging a number of proposals that would try to tackle some of the expressed concerns.
Let me grab a call about that from Chris in Fargo, North Dakota. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi. What'd you want to know?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question relates to overhead expenses when comparing a single-payer system to our current system of many smaller competing health insurance agencies. How do costs and prescription prices and administrative expenses differ for comparable services between public and private? Thanks.
Yeah, Danya, could you take that on?
Sure. In general, we've found that the private programs do have lower overall administrative expenses. As far as other services go, that kind of varies depending on the program, on the plan you look at. Right now, we have with a healthcare system, both on the provider side and the prescription drug side, a situation really where plans negotiate for prices. And that means the public plans have, some public plans like the VA plans, may be able to negotiate to a certain degree more, or, in Medicare, there are, set limits of prices, and plans then negotiate in the individual market. And sometimes they're higher, sometimes they're lower, what the actual price is kind of across the board. But if we did switch, if we switch from a system where we have private insurers to a full public program, there is a certain level that, the prices are going to adjust from what we see now between those two programs, because providers, prescription, the drug manufacturers are still going to want to get paid. So even if a program, there's an area where there's right now lower reimbursement, you may see those reimbursements increase if you have, that being the only payer in the system, if that were to be where we moved.
Mark says single-payer systems around the world, per capita spending that cover everyone, is on par with just the spending we already pay through government. Everything else we pay, like employer providing coverage, is all extra that drives two times the cost in the United States. Gene, I mean, we talk about healthcare so often that I know we've repeated this. We pay more, much more. Our health care is not among the best in the world. Does Mark pretty much have the numbers right on that?
Yeah, so they're close, and I give him a lot of credit for that, because no doubt the U.S. healthcare system is the most expensive in the world, and on a per-person basis, the next most expensive country is about half of what we spend per person. So not a close call. It's interesting because you see a couple things that are going on, though, because really, there aren't that many pure single-payer systems in the world. Maybe England or Taiwan comes closest. But
meaning what? That they're a
meaning,
mix? Yeah.
Go to Canada, and it's more of a state-based system. They have provincial budgets, and they work within that, so it's not the same everywhere in Canada. Go to Australia, and they do have their own Medicare-like program, but it covers a base set of benefits, and there's private insurance on top of it. So I do think when we begin to do these comparisons, we should look hard, because even Medicare in our own country is not single payer, because people do pay premiums, they pay coinsurance.
Right.
There's private plans and Medicare Advantage. So I think we have to have this robust debate about what is it that's wrong with our health system, what's right with it, and how do we make more of it work?
Danya, I was just going to ask you about that. Often when we get into this single-payer debate and we're looking at other countries that are doing this, we're hearing, yeah, but Canadians buy additional private insurance because they're not satisfied with accessibility, in their own system. And we see that in the UK. Is that necessarily a knock against single-payer, or is that probably the kind of single payer, if it were to happen in the United States, that we'd be looking at too?
Right. I mean, I think we would be looking at a lot of different options in the United States, because there's many directions we can go. But it's not necessarily a knock to a system that people are purchasing something private to go above and beyond that. People do that right now with Medicare. They buy supplemental plans. Some people even do that with private insurance, where they might buy something that is a wraparound to their insurance. There's even in some places, you know, alternative health insurance plans that are covering some alternative complementary services that aren't covered by insurance. And there is a certain reality that people who can afford it may look to buy something above and beyond a base package. But of course, if everyone in the country automatically had access to a base package, then everyone in the country is having a minimum level of benefit.
Right. You have a floor of health insurance coverage, right? And you can build up from there as you want to?
Exactly. And part of the debate would be, you know, what is that floor? What is the right floor for our country? And, you know, it may, you know, like Canada varies by province, it may vary by state. In the United States, it may not, you know, but that's part of the debate we have to have.
Danya Palenker here with us from Georgetown's Health Policy Institute, Jean Lambrew with us from the Century Foundation. And my question to you as listeners and voters is, if you were a midterm healthcare voter, and there were a lot of you, what exactly were you saying about healthcare? And I'm asking you this morning not just to call in and say, because I want healthcare for everyone. I'd like you to be specific. What is it that creates anxiety for you about healthcare, and it was motivating you as a voter? Is it high premiums? You know, we've talked about that at length. Is it high deductibles? We've also talked about that recently. I'm going to ask our guests about that. Is it this idea that you're in a job and your health insurance is tied to that job, but you're worried about what happens to the health insurance if you lose that job or taking that insurance with you? Be a little more specific with me this morning about what it is that creates your interest and anxiety about health care. 800-242-2828, wherever you are in the region, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, to Pam in St. Paul. Hi, Pam.
Hello. I'm calling because my husband is retired military, and so we have care. I have pre-existing conditions. One is cancer. And we find that this base, you know, when they're talking about the access of a base,
yeah,
that this is what we have, and I'm so grateful for it. I can't imagine how anybody can exist without that in this country, and what that takes away from the stressors of just having to navigate my illness.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is I wanted to ask about, I think it was during the Nixon administration, when we changed this to profit. Prior, you know, we had military access 20 years ago. It was not like it is today. It is so much better. And the other thing I wanted to ask about is the verbiage around a single-payer system, because TRICARE is, I believe, a single-payer system.
Through the VA. Uh-huh.
Correct. And it really is a very good base. And then it's how we talk about this. You know, the opposition of having health care for everyone is like, oh, you know, this is a horrible thing and it's going to be lines and all that. And that's just sort of a fear-mongering way to deal with health care. We have the ability to do this.
Yeah, Pam, there's plenty of demagoguery in the health care debate, no question. But you've brought up an interesting question about the VA, and we had a caller on that earlier, so I'll come back to that. Danya, we heard our caller ask about whether there is a move to try to privatize the VA coverage. And then let's blend in what our caller is also asking about here. What should we understand about the VA as maybe a model for some changes?
Right. I mean, and first, I want to note that, you know, we've got the VA health system, which provides direct health care, not health coverage, but health services to many of our veterans.
Good note. Yes.
And TRICARE is really an insurance plan that is provided and available to our veterans. And you know, they are two different things. That's important to note. There has been some discussion in the recent year about privatizing the VA services, which has really been about taking those the health services that are provided in government-run medical facilities and making them private facilities, or making some of them private facilities or privately administered. So there have been those discussions going on this last year. And that's really, I think, very in the VA is what I think some people in the very large view of single payer think of. It's like the national health system in the UK, where the government really is running the medical system. But many of the single payer proposals that actually get talked about in the United States are not talking about or considering actually having the government employ the doctors and the medical providers in the system, but it's really talking about, you know, the government either administering the benefits or somehow it being the government money reimbursing the system. There are, of course, some people who are talking about the broader UK system, but you can say, if you talk to 50 different people about single payer, you're probably talking about 50 different proposals.
Okay. So, Jean, what do we take from the VA? Given what Danya just said about they operate in a different way than some single payer system would be created. But what else should we understand about how the VA works?
Sure. I think that what is fairly unique about the VA is, again, salaried physicians, hospitals that are owned in large part by the Veterans Administration. But I also think we see, as we were talking earlier about Canada and people buying supplemental insurance, there was a VA choice proposal that got enacted a few years ago to try to ensure that veterans who do not live close to those facilities or those providers who have long wait times get access to them. I think that's a proposal that's being implemented and being tested, and we'll see what's there. But I do think the larger lesson is typically you have to have a mix of these systems where you have kind of salaried and owned hospitals, and that's also what happens in big HMOs like Kaiser Permanente, as well as like making sure we have, in this large and very diverse country, access points for people who need them.
And when our caller asked about what he called under-the-table privatization, I want to make sure Ken and I were talking about the right thing, Jean. It was going outside the VA to provide quicker, more accessible health care. Is that right?
Yeah, and more of the VA budget going instead of to VA facilities to private doctors and private hospitals. And there's an open question about if that happens in a large way, is it going to undermine the budgets for the VA facilities and leave them worse off than they are and let them so-called wither on the vine?
Okay. Terry Ann says on Twitter, I'm 53. I have great health insurance, but I'd like to retire early, and I'm not sure that's possible in the current healthcare situation. More importantly, I have a 25-year-old with a pre-existing condition. Even more worried for him. Danya, I talked about this with Ken. The debate about pre-existing conditions really seemed to produce some anxiety in voters and motivate them as voters in the midterms. Where does that stand? For now, the ACA is not going to pass. Some kind of repeal of the ACA is not going to pass the House. But specifically to this issue about pre-existing conditions, what happens next, do you think?
So with pre-existing conditions, as you said, nothing is going to pass the House in the next 2 years that's going to repeal the ACA. And from that, I don't see anything passing that's going to undermine the pre-existing condition protections. And so they are the law right now. There is a court case in Texas where a number of state's attorneys general have brought a case against the Affordable Care Act, which is based on the fact that last year the mandate penalty was repealed, but technically the mandate still exists. So the basic claim is without a tax, the existing mandate, which has no power, is unconstitutional, and the entire Affordable Care Act should be eliminated by the court. And the federal government, Department of Justice, is not defending the entire law and is actually saying that some of the pre-existing condition protections should go away, while we have some other states that have come in to defend the law. So that we don't have an initial decision, but that is a case that has to be watched because there is a potential for the courts to act on this issue, even if there's a decision quickly. I strongly expect any decision will be appealed and moved up, but that's sort of the place to watch right now. But I mean, as of now, the pre-existing condition protections do continue to be here, and politically, I don't see them going anywhere by Congress.
A call here from Chris in Avon, Minnesota. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Yeah, I was certainly a healthcare voter, and my concern is pre-existing conditions and the cost of drugs. My husband's a diabetic, and his insulin costs us a fortune. And my daughter has a chronic illness, and she's 23. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about her when she goes off of our insurance. We pay for our own insurance. Our premiums are insane, but we can afford it. But will she be able to? That's my concern.
Right. Two people in your family that this really affects directly. I appreciate the insight on that, Chris. To Jack in Rochester, Minnesota. Hey, Jack, you're 22. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm 22, recently graduated, and I'm wanting to be a freelance videographer. Uh-huh. And currently I'm on my parents' health care until 26. And I'm just concerned about what's going to happen once I hit that age, if I'm not getting it through employer, and then also everyone else in Minnesota and the U.S. that is moving towards a gig economy and really doing their own thing.
I think this is a really good question, Gene, for what the next generation is going to work. This brings us back to healthcare attached to employers. Is anybody thinking about that in Washington?
Sure. I would say that the Affordable Care Act had that in mind in part when we were putting into effect the pre-existing condition protections, which, as a reminder, means you cannot be denied coverage, you cannot be charged more for coverage based on your health, and once you have that coverage, an insurance plan can't say, I'm not going to pay for the treatment for your pre-existing condition. And in fact, that has been successful enough for people who are working on their own that one out of five of every person, people, of everybody in the marketplace in the United States is a self-employed person or entrepreneur. So it has been successful, but I don't want to we need to talk about the election and what this does mean for these protections.
Okay.
Because, you know, the Republicans who said, oh, we care about pre-existing conditions, did introduce a bill. So if this Texas lawsuit, if the people trying to roll back these pre-existing conditions,
these attorneys general,
succeed,
right?
There's a bill that would say, well, we'll require insurance companies to give you an offer. We won't let them charge more for you. But you know what? If you have a pre-existing condition, your plan doesn't have to cover it. So even the Republican solution to the lawsuit has gaps in it. And people with employer-based coverage need to be worried as well, because some of those insurance reforms do apply to employer-based coverage. And before the Affordable Care Act, there could be annual limits on coverage, lifetime limits on coverage, unlimited, you know, out-of-pocket costs for an insurance plan, and those are parts of the Affordable Care Act that affect the employer-based system that were at risk last year, but hopefully won't be at risk going forward.
I have to say, Jane, I'm puzzled when Republicans run on let the market decide, because you've just run down a list of things that Americans were really upset about before the ACA. Now, they remain ambivalent. I was just looking at polling about the ACA. But those things that you just mentioned were things that were really concerning to Americans. And it sounds like what you've said is, even if this lawsuit goes forward, the legislation that's the stop, you know, the backstop to that is not going to allay a lot of those concerns.
Yes, and I'll keep going, that the Trump administration has been issuing executive actions and regulations that would allow so-called short-term health plans that can be sold for up to 3 years to go back to the olden days of denying people coverage, charging them more, you know, excluding key benefits, rescinding coverage. People forget, but now we're back to a world in which these short-term plans can look after somebody buys coverage, they get sick, they look back on the application and said, aha, you did not complete this application completely or honestly, we're going to take away your coverage and not pay for it even if you paid your premium. So that's happening now. These new short-term plans are being sold as we speak, and there may be an effort by the House to slow down, if not stop, those plans from being sold.
The offering of those plans, yeah.
But just note that the threat for people with pre-existing conditions continues so long as the president continues to push for these types of policies that don't include the full set of protections.
You know, this is kind of the disconnect, Danya. I mean, we had Americans who did not like a lot of what was going on in the health insurance market before the ACA. But many of those same Americans don't like the ACA very much. And I wonder if some of this is, well, I thought they were going to do something about premiums and I'm still the deductibles. I'm still paying high deductibles, that it didn't solve a lot of the problems that people are feeling in their own households about this.
Yeah, part of the problem is actually that the Affordable Care Act had so many pieces that were, you know, that needed to take time to implement. It's just a reality. The exchanges don't get up. You can't create a new insurance market in a day. And so there were actually a number of years where people were criticizing the law before people really saw what the law was doing. And because of that, I think people have a disconnect between what they think of as the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare and the protections the law provides, the pre-existing condition protections, the no limit, the no annual or lifetime limits, the coverage of preventive services without cost sharing. You know, people don't always connect the two and realize the two are the same law. And even the Medicaid expansion, which we saw, Minnesota had already expanded, but
right,
three other states voted to expand. That was literally on the ballot to expand health care under Obamacare.
Right.
And a lot of people don't see that as Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act.
That's interesting.
That some of that is political, the political messaging people took away and got, and decided there was a negative feeling with a law before they realized what the benefits were, and then they just started learning and wanting to hold on to these really important benefits.
To be fair, it is extremely complicated. I do understand that. And so you can't blame voters for not understanding all the ins and outs of it. But what you just said about the Medicaid expansion, I think that's part of the reason that Scott Walker may have lost in Wisconsin. And some members of Congress, Republican members of Congress who were in, pretty safe districts ended up being voted out. I don't know. Texas might be part of that. Interesting to see the analysis. Yeah, Jane.
There is a guy named Representative MacArthur from New Jersey who championed the House bill to repeal and replace Affordable Care Act. He lost. We saw a nurse who used to work in the Obama administration, Lauren Underwood, win. We saw Donna Shalala, the former Secretary of Health and Human Services, win in Florida. I do think that elections do have consequences, and health care was on the ballot in a bunch of different ways.
KJ says on Twitter, what causes me the most anxiety is the fact that healthcare and insurance providers are for-profit organizations in this country. At the end of the day, healthcare is about making money for shareholders, not about making our citizens healthier. And I'm hearing a lot of that kind of sentiment on Twitter. Danya, let me come back to you on that there's a perception, at least in this state, that healthcare companies are not in this for the common good, that it's about making money.
Yeah, I mean, there are actually a lot of nonprofit health insurance, health insurers. If they're not technically companies, there are a lot of nonprofit health insurers, and there are a lot of for-profit health insurers in the country. And, it's not always very obvious when you're enrolling or in a plan. But that has, I think that has been an issue when back, if we go back about almost 10 years now to, the effort, or actually it was 10 years for the efforts to start passing the Affordable Care Act, that was a lot of the messaging was the profits going to insurance companies, the, the salaries that these insurers made. And another really important piece of the Affordable Care Act, which doesn't get a lot of attention, is that, 80% of the dollars that insurance company collects has to go back
right.
to providing medical costs or improving quality. And that's not just that 20% can go to profit. That 20% is including the administrative costs, the marketing, all of that within there to really ensure that that money that those insurers are collecting is being spent on the enrollees.
Yeah, I mean, the ACA put a cap on the kind of profits that healthcare companies could make. Yes?
Effectively they did.
Okay, call here from Melissa in St. Paul. Hey, Melissa. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, I was just calling. I am not a single issue voter, but healthcare was definitely on my list of very important things. I have employer-sponsored insurance, and they pay probably about $16,000 a year for my son and I. He's 21.
Mm-hmm.
And we still have to pay $6,000 or $7,000 out of pocket before our insurance kicks in.
Wow, you have a high deductible.
We have a really high deductible. So, in effect, it makes healthcare unaffordable for us. We really, we might go in for a few preventative types of things, but we really don't go to the doctor.
Because you have to pay out of the pocket, even though you're also paying out of the pocket. So you are paying, I'm sure you're paying your share through your employer of your health insurance, right?
My employer covers that $16,000, but then we have, like I said, $6,000 or $7,000 more that we have to pay. So for everything we go in for, except for, routine checkups or whatever, but we're paying then out of pocket. So, I had the flu last year and ended up with a $2,000 bill from the hospital.
Ouch. Oh, my gosh.
So, just to be able to pay $2,000 out of pocket like that, even though I have an HSA,
it puts me in this
place where, it sure did.
Melissa, were you one of those people that the flu shot didn't work for last year? Because that sounds serious.
I got the flu at the beginning of September, so I hadn't gotten a flu shot yet. And they, it didn't come up as being the flu, but as I started reading about the flu, it was definitely the flu.
Wow.
2 nights in the hospital, and I'm a very healthy person.
Yeah, so. That's it's kind of scary. Reminder for all of us to get flu shots, but thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Jean, we talked about high deductibles about 2 weeks ago. Heard from many, many people who are in Melissa's situation. I can't afford to use my health care because my deductible is so high. And one of the things that emerged in the conversation was people think they're saving money when they choose these high deductible plans. But in the end, it ends up sometimes being more expensive. What do you think we ought to understand about that?
Sure. That very interestingly, because these high deductibles are not something that people want, we've begun to see a trend in employer coverage where they're not increasing as fast as they were. They're kind of slowing down.
Right.
So that's maybe a response to the concerns that people are expressing. Indeed, the Affordable Care Act did, out of concern for the deductibles, require insurance companies to cover preventive services, well child visits, annual women's wellness visits below the deductible without cost sharing because of the concern about these high deductibles. But indeed, over the past number of years, we've seen proposals to advance consumer-driven health care with health savings accounts march through Congress. And in fact, in this lame duck session that we're going to see in the next couple of months, there's an expectation that Republicans will try yet again to pass more tax breaks to the tune of tens of billions of dollars to promote these health savings accounts. I would not be surprised if next year the House changes and begins to look at putting more services below those very high deductibles as a first step towards addressing the concern.
Jean, I really appreciate the time and the insight for the show. Thanks much.
Thanks for having me.
Let me grab one last call here from Natalie. Natalie, I have about 90 seconds, but I want to do a show on what you're bringing up. So talk to us here.
My biggest concern, I'm a chiropractor, so I talk to people a lot about insurance. I actually have a cash practice because I choose not to be involved with the insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
And the key is just keeping my prices a little lower so care is affordable for people. But my biggest issue is, like you were saying before, is at the household level, because I've encountered this certainly with my family, and I hear a lot of people talking about it, is the transparency of the industry. So many times, you have to be at a certain, level of education to understand, explanation of benefits and things to get in the mail. And so many times stuff just isn't itemized and outlined and you don't know what you're being charged for. And then, you know, like you said, a lot of people have high deductibles and, you know, they're expecting things to be covered. And then all of a sudden they end up with these thousands of dollars of bills when they have health insurance.
Yeah, it's been a while since we did a show about transparency in medical charges. So, Natalie, I appreciate you bringing that up. Danya, more to be said on that. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again about this. This is really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
More health care coverage to come. I want to let you know we hear you. This is an interesting and urgent issue for you, and we'll continue to come back to it and talk about it.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828. Or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.